Hi, I'm Mick Leach, your host and guide on this exciting journey into the SOC universe. In each episode, I chat with various cybersecurity professionals about the latest industry news, emerging threats, practical strategies to keep your organization safe, and more. And this week, we are excited to have Dave Kennedy. Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Mick, thanks so much for having me on. It's a total pleasure to be here, man, and appreciate what you folks do for spreading information out there. And the purpose is all mine.
Yeah, absolutely. So first, I wanted to just open up. I know you. I've known you for a long time. You're a big pillar in the community, but maybe some folks tuning in don't know who you are and your background. So if you could, tell us a little bit about yourself, what your current role is, and how you got there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am the founder and chief hacking officer. When you get to be an owner of multiple companies, you can create your titles, which is cool. So I thought chief hacking officer sounded pretty good. It's actually a funny story. Kevin Mitnick, who passed away recently from pancreatic cancer, he's one of my best friends. And him and I were talking about titles we can give ourselves that are cool. So he and I came up with a chief hacking officer title. So he became chief hacking officer at KnowBefore, and then I became chief hacking officer for TrustedSec and Binary Defense. We are a global company. Between the two companies, I think we have over 400 and some employees worldwide. We work with a lot of the big organizations out there to the small. We focus on everything from incident response, managed detection response, MSSP work, SOC operations, those types of things, all the way down to consulting work, down to penetration testing, red teaming, application security, everything. But pretty much do all the board. I'm a technical person. I wrote a number of exploitation frameworks. I was on the Kali Linux development team, so the Backtrack development team at the time before it became Kali Linux. I wrote a number of exploits, zero days, research papers, guides. A kind of a cool title that I have that not a lot of folks know is Jeff Snover, who wrote PowerShell, considers me the father of PowerShell security, which is kind of a cool title.
Interesting.
So I did the very first ever PowerShell security talk at DEF CON with my good buddy Josh Kelly. And I got the title Father of PowerShell Security. I started the whole PowerShell security movement, which is pretty cool. So
I love
long lineage in cybersecurity. I think I got about 27 years. Worked for the NSA doing cyber warfare, which kind of started off my career. So I worked actually in Hawaii. I was a few doors down from Edward Snowden in Kenya at the same time. So didn't know who he was or anything like that. But, and then did a couple tours in Iraq for intelligence related missions and then got out and been everything from a chief security officer for a Fortune 1000 company to starting my own businesses in the basement of my house to what you see today. So
awesome. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for your service. I love talking with fellow veterans, even if they're Marines. We can overlook that as an Army guy.
I appreciate it. I'll overlook my bias as well, but
absolutely. I love it. The beauty for those of you tuning in who don't know, the different folks from the military services love to kind of give each other grief. It's all in jest. And it's all in good heart.
All love and respect.
So moving forward, what inspired you to pursue a career in cybersecurity? How did you find your way into sort of that SOC environment? I heard you did some work with the NSA before starting your own companies. How did you get there?
Yeah, I got so fortunate early on because I was really heavy into computers prior to even joining the military. I was running my own MUD, multi-user dimension, which is, text-based video games. I had my own BBS that was running. We had like 500, players online. And, I was an op at like 16, 17 years old, coding in C, C++. I actually, pretty much skipped high school and failed out of high school. And I had to go back to summer school just to pass because I was so obsessed with tearing apart computers, figuring out how they worked, programming. So my mind always worked. The best way I can explain it is, when I don't understand how something works, I obsess about it in a way that I want to dive down into that subject and become kind of an expert in it. And so like for computers, I couldn't understand how electricity turned into certain types of current that then modulated to a circuit board that then, propagated up to code that binary code translated to assembly code and that assembly code translated to other programming languages that gave you this user experience. So I just needed to understand that. And I didn't think, cybersecurity wasn't really even a industry at that point in time. This is, circa 2000. So probably, 95, 96. And so, I just knew that I loved computers. And then when I went into the Marines, I tested very highly on what's called the ASVAB test, the aptitude test, as you're familiar with. The Marines are great because they'll guarantee you a position. So if you sign up for intelligence, for example, you will get intelligence. They can't move you to a different group or anything like that without your permission. Mm-hmm. And so I picked intelligence because I thought, top secret clearance. I would learn whether or not there's aliens or not. That was my big thing, aliens. So.
I love it.
Yeah, so I was like, hey, I'm going to get a top secret clearance. I'm going to know if there's aliens. And I actually told my buddy, Sean, he's my best man at my wedding. I was like, Sean, dude, if I call you at like 2 o'clock in the morning and I say yes and I hang up, there's aliens, all right? And never made that call, unfortunately, and never knew because, you know, even if there are aliens, have no idea. You know, I can't even, you know, can't confirm nor deny. But even if there were aliens, I would never be read into those programs because it wasn't part of my job or mission, right? Sure. You know, the government's very specific off of that. But the military, the Marines specifically, saw my knack for computers, and I was able to get into a very specialized group that was focused on computer exploitation. So I went to, you know, a school in Pensacola to learn network exploitation, got really heavy into offensive capabilities and cyber warfare, the early days of cyber warfare. And that's really what kicked off my career getting into cybersecurity. I just absolutely loved it. I mean, breaking into, you know, countries and you know, hacking into the we're doing crazy stuff here, you know, 2002, 2003, you know, even going into Iraq, you know, cracking all the signals and things like that. And then, you know, being able to do certain things there. It was such an amazing experience at such a young age to be able to do that. It really forged my career getting into the private sector.
That is fantastic. So with that vast, rich history of things that you've done, super cool stuff, you probably have some stories. So
yeah, plenty.
Can you describe a particularly challenging cybersecurity threat or attack that you've encountered and kind of how you guys responded to it?
Yeah. So, you know, being an owner of multiple companies, I get to see a large breadth of things. And while my career has been predominantly offensive, it really hasn't been. It's been offense and defense. I've been really focusing extremely heavy, especially over the past 10 years, on how do we build systems or an organization to build a security program that's successful in defending the types of attacks that we see. You know, as a chief security officer, I was the chief security officer for Diebold. I came in after the voting machine issue. I just want to throw that out there. You know, built an amazing security program that at the time was, you know, very much state of the art. So, you know, my career is definitely offense and defense. But I think by understanding offense, you have a much clearer picture about the best way to defend against the attackers, right? Which is why I think you see such a hybrid approach in cybersecurity to defending, right? You can't defend something you don't understand. So if an exploit's being fired at you or there's a suspicious behavior, let's just say you see a living off the land binary script and it's, you know, calling a specific DLL. Well, as an attacker, I know that's malicious, but if you don't understand the offensive capabilities of that as a defender, you're going to miss that. It's going to be a false positive, right? And so I think, you know, a story that comes up to me is actually a really big recent one where we dealt with, so if you look at, you know, our security operations center, you know, one of the things we've been able to do extremely well as of late, and I understand this is a big buzzword, but is incorporate a lot of large language models, artificial intelligence, and machine learning into becoming more efficient. Now, you know, I'm not here to say that AI is going to replace humans and, you know, we're going to have, you know, cyborg body parts and things like that. But there are certain applied principles and use cases that you can leverage these types of things. And think of this as, you know, the needle in the haystack. You know, you don't want an analyst combing through that haystack trying to find a needle. If you could leverage, you know, more automated ways of being able to respond to that and then centralize all that data to an analyst, you know, that's a better way of being able to do it. And so this is a cool one. One of our data scientists, Angus, was we have a data lakehouse and we're always applying different models and they're unsupervised. So they're, you know, kind of taking a look at all the data that we have being ingested into us. And Angus had triggered a new language model that we were training to look at service creation probability of maliciousness. So, you know, taking a look at all services, all data, you know, and then looking for abnormal baselines of things that don't make sense. And if you think about data in itself, you know, most of the time attacks are going to be this really tiny blip of a standardized data, you know, a data set across your entire environment, right? You know, you have normal behavior that is exhibited every single day. And if you look at that behavior, that's this large copious amounts of noise. And if you look at it as like a pie chart or a chart going downward, you know, a graph, you know, down here, these little tiny things over here are the things that we miss, right? These little tiny one hit or two hit type of things. And Angus had put this new model up in place and it literally bubbled up this service creation that was suspicious. And we had missed it from an analyst perspective because it looked like a legitimate one, but based on the behavior that it was exhibiting, bubbled it up and it was a malicious, you know, service that was created. So we're able to respond and minimize the threat based off of that specific issue, based on just training a new model that we hadn't tried before, that needle in the haystack that we may have missed, you know, as we're coming along. So for me, the exciting part, and I think, you know, as an industry, we have to focus on more is those behavioral elements. When you make security, your own based on your environment, because your environment is completely different than anybody else out there, completely unique. You know, you might have different programmers, different web applications, different third-party services, different people, different technologies. You know, that makes you unique. So if you can baseline your own environment and look for those deviations of patterns of behavior, that's where your butt's going to be saved versus, you know, anything else that's typically happening to these big data breaches that we see out there.
Yeah, that is awesome. And I will throw a disclaimer out there, because that is exactly at the heart of what we here at Abnormal are doing with in terms of email and messaging security, SaaS security, is that behavioral data science, that behavioral analysis to identify anomalous activity. So, Dave, you know, keep me honest here. We didn't put you up to that. That's your own thoughts.
No, 100%. Absolutely. And, you know, but I think that's, you know, when you look at where a lot of the innovation in this industry is happening today, it's around the behavioral analytics. Like here's the thing, like if you look at EDRs today, okay, and I'm not saying EDRs are a bad thing. They're great. You know, from a visibility perspective, being able to see the data that's coming out of there, they're fantastic. However, just like the issues that we ran into with antivirus, EDRs are still predominantly signature-based detections. They look for previously defined data sets or data breaches from previous adversaries, which, again, I'm not discrediting. I think that's a great thing that you have this cache of previous data that's happening out there to respond to. But if you're anywhere of a savvy attacker, you're going to understand, hey, if I'm going against this specific EDR product, which, by the way, if I go to LinkedIn and I look at the experience of the employees there, I know which EDR you're using based on the experience that you list on your public profile. I know I need to get around this specific technology. And if I know you have this specific technology and it's out of the box, here's the things that I can do to get around that so I don't get detected by this specific piece of technology, right? And, you know, where really I think a lot of the innovation's coming to is saying, well, that gives you an average level or maybe even a little bit below average level of protection. But when you start to look at your own environment and you make those tools morph to yourself and you start applying some of these principles that we have, newer technologies or newer ways of looking at data sets, you have a much better chance of understanding these threats. Another story I'll tell you, we had an incident recently where we had an organization that we're doing a threat hunt for. And we looked at their baselines and they were using Microsoft Remote Assistance and Intune kind of for the remote management and stuff like that, right? So that's their baseline. Sure. That's the high data set, right? But we noticed that there was two machines in their environment that had TeamViewer installed. And TeamViewer is, you know, a corporate application, enterprise licensed, you know, type of thing. It could be used maliciously, it could be used corporate, you know. But why is there a baseline of Intune Remote Assistance when there's two deviations here of two outliers of TeamViewer? And we investigated it, and there were two compromised machines that just happened a few hours before, had been social engineered over the phone, pretending to be the help desk, and had downloaded TeamViewer maliciously and were in the process of, you know, attacking the rest of the infrastructure. But if you have an EDR product, the EDR product might log the data that TeamViewer was installed, but it's not going to report that it's malicious because it's a legitimate application. So, you know, that's the problem that we run into today, is that attackers are very savvy at understanding we may have these products in place. And unless we have our own defensive mechanisms in place around our own environment, what makes our own environment unique, we're really going to be caught off guard with, I think, a lot more data breaches that we see.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that really speaks to the thing that bothers me the most with where we are today in terms of the solutions that we're bringing in. They're great at what they do,
right,
but they're also siloed. They don't integrate very well. I mean, I think that's what SIEMs were supposed to do for us.
Now we were supposed to be dying pretty much across the board.
Yeah. And they never really, I think they always fell short in terms of uniting all of that data and really understanding the across the breadth of your environment, what's really happening. So I think that still remains a place that we need to continue to work on. So,
and that's been a challenge for us at Binary. You know, like we're one of the only open XDR companies out there where we'll use the technology stack of the customer. You can use our own platform or whatever. But what's interesting about us is we have to integrate into, you know, the top 5 to 8 SIEMs. We have to integrate into multiple EDR products. We have to email gateways, cloud infrastructure, cloud gateways, cloud spam filtering, you know, you name it. We have to integrate into everything. And so, you know, to consolidate that and centralize that was a major uplift for us, you know, let alone an individual company that has to just deal with, you know, 5 or 10 or 20 disparate technologies. You know, we're dealing with hundreds. So the way that we kind of adopted this is we leveraged SOAR extremely heavily and think of SOAR as kind of the plumbing between all of the different technologies to centralize all that data, standardize our detection engineering process based off of that data that we have coming across the board. And then from there, being able to apply that across all of our customers and then centralize it to our analysts. So our analysts have one single, you know, pane of glass that pulls in our threat intelligence, pulls in our data analytics, our data science, pulls in, you know, our counterintelligence, anything else that goes into there, combines it all into one so that the analyst has a full representation of what's happening, but still allowing them to be flexible to get into the individual tools if they have to, yep, to kind of investigate or respond to see what's happening. But, you know, I don't envy the complexities that we have today in the enterprise. You know, you look at businesses and, you know, they're continuously pushing cloud. Cloud typically has a very tough time with visibility, unless they're security products that are designed to integrate with others. But, you know, most cases you look at like Microsoft 365, you know, it's very difficult to get amazing visibility. And then you have to pay for premium tier licensing to even get that. So, you know, you're continuously evolving technology in your organization to allow your organization to grow. And at the same time, you have to reduce the complexity because you don't have enough analysts and people and data and everything else to be able to handle that volume. It's just this really big, weird spot, I think, that we're in today, just based on how fast technology is progressing and how security is really just trying to catch up with that. I think we had a really good handle on it with kind of the waterfall approach for web applications. You know, like we were the showstoppers, right? We're like, hey, this can't go into production until we check it out. And then we went into agile workflow and that went to hell in a handbasket. We lost our whole control over that. And then the whole, you know, IT infrastructure took up agile. You know, we have to be pushing out iterations and getting things out as quick as possible. And then security comes in after the fact, after the security vulnerabilities and exposures are all out there trying to kind of retroactively bolt things on to try to fix it. You know, think of it as a starship. You know, you have these holes that are leaking air. Oh, hey, we have air leaking. We're going to bolt down really quick to fix it while we're in space. You know, it's a it's a tough challenge that we're running into right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we've talked a little bit about the past. What is, in terms of present, what are the biggest threats that you see out in the, you know, in the wild today? What are the biggest threats that our companies are facing?
Yeah, I think it's really three big things that I think most companies are really facing from an adversaries or a tactics, techniques, and procedures perspective. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, you know, we're used to the Russian accents or Eastern European accents calling us on the phone. But with a lot of the voice modulation software that we have now, you can remove those. You can appear to be somebody from the South. You could be, you know, a woman, a man, whatever you want to be on the phone and appear to be anybody. And if you look at what happened with MGM, Caesars, and a few others, you know, calling up the help desk on the phone, there's a talk you can go back to that I gave several years ago. I'm talking probably 15 years ago I gave this talk. And I gave an example about what is a help desk designed to do? Well, what's the help desk function? It's there to help, right? So you're taking a role and a function within organizations that's supposed to help. They're dealing with hundreds, if not thousands of customers a day, you know, at volume and scale, depending on the size of the company. And they have to be able to be on edge at all times too, which doesn't work really well. And so now you have voice modulation software. It doesn't sound suspicious. They've already done their homework. They have previous breach data in many cases. So they're compiling previous breach data to associating the pretext that they're going to use for the attacks. Then they call up the help desk and they're well-versed to what they're doing. And so, you know, the help desk challenge right now is a major conduit area that I see as a major exposure and vulnerability. In fact, I did a talk at DEF CON with Kevin Mitnick, and we did a lot. It was one of my best talks, favorite talks of all time. And I called Kevin up on stage randomly, and we had got permission from one of our customers. And I called the help desk. I had Kevin call the help desk. I ran the technical stuff behind the scenes. And Kevin, social engineer, the help desk person, downloaded some malware. We had an interpreter running on their, you know, live. And this is in front of like 6,000 people in the audience. Everybody's super quiet because, you know, we're live on the phone. And as soon as we hang up, everybody starts going crazy. But it was literally 4 minutes of talking to somebody to get somebody to go and click on things. So I think, you know, the social engineering aspects and the sophistication that has gone into those, and not just in corporations, like the sophistication levels of social engineering going down to the individual personal level has hit an all-time high. I just had a family member that got hit with probably one of the most sophisticated attacks. And I was like, I couldn't believe how complex this attack was. I mean, they spoofed their phone number coming from Chase. They knew they had Chase account. They already had access to their email. So they knew all the bank accounts they had. They were listing transactions that they knew were legitimate because the financial statements were attached to the PDFs. And they were able to coax them through getting through their multi-factor authentication so they can get access to their bank accounts and then drained all their bank accounts. You know, it's you look at that and you say that's an individual level. And they're, you know, they unfortunately got about 80K off of them, but 80K is an amazing payday for these attackers that spend maybe a few hours using previous breach data, credential stuffing, get access to an email, you know, build an amount of data, then call them up on the phone. It's elaborate, it's sophisticated. And I think that the social engineering aspects of things is at an all-time high, all-time criticality.
Yeah. And so back to that that demonstration at DEF CON, keep me honest here. I believe that Mick Douglas, my last guest, was in a chicken costume.
Yes.
On stage for that. Is that right?
That's a great memory. That's a great memory. Oh my God. And Mick was the chicken in the background holding the sign, "Let's pop a box."
Yes.
And, you know, my favorite talks at DEF CON were always the ShmooCon group, you know, mm-hmm. the Cult of the Dead Cows, like, you know, like some of the really, you know, loft, some of the amazing, like, folks that really forged the industry, you know, that the industry is really kind of built upon. And, you know, CDC would come out with like these skulls and everything, these cow skulls, and, you know, the showmanship and the presentation of it was awesome. So, you know, for me, I always wanted to recreate that and have some fun as I'm doing it. Like, I remember one of them, you know, I found a vulnerability in SCCM where you can patch an SCCM server, deploy malware to the entire company. So I patched my entire company, you know, a Fortune 1000 company, patched it all live with malware, live on stage. So I had like 15,000 shells ringing at heavy metal with a lighter in the air, you know, like it's those types of things that, you know, I thought were really cool. And Mick was awesome. It literally just came out of the thing like, man, I don't feel like we have enough. We're going to be social engineering, you know, someone live on stage, but we need like a little bit more. And I'm like, what if we have a chicken costume? Mick's like, I'll go get a chicken costume. I'm like, yeah, let's go get a chicken costume. And then we'll be on stage with like chicken costumes. And like, this is how it started. So, you know, there's no rhyme or reason. Just thought it'd be good to have a chicken costume.
Absolutely epic. And you're right. It does go down in history as one of the best talks I've ever seen. Up there with John Strand's talk about his mom, sending his mom to prison.
Yes.
And then
John
he
is amazing.
Yes.
I love John.
Oh, me too. So we've talked a little bit about the past. We've talked a little bit about the present. Now it's time for the future. What advancements or changes do you see in the field of cybersecurity, and how do you think they're going to impact the SOC?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a big push and focus on data normalization now. You know, I think, you know, what at least machine learning has done, and I hate to say AI because it's not really AI yet. I mean, generative AI is good for like programming things, and there's some good functions for that. Like, for example, it's not just good at human language, it's great at like PowerShell and C and assembly and things like that, right? It can analyze, you know, abnormal patterns and code very quickly, which I can tell you a story about that. But where I think machine learning really has an applied principle is taking all of these different data sets, normalizing them in a way that you can consistently apply them across your entire organization. And, you know, the biggest challenge I think most companies face is how do you apply a detection engineering strategy to an organization that is continuously changing and adopting different technologies? And how do you keep up with the latest and greatest threats that are out there? So I think, you know, with machine learning being more and more adopted, the models becoming a lot more accessible, easier ways to go and do it, security products, integrating them. I do think defensively, we will have much better visibility into the threats and attacks that are happening out there. You know, we're not going to fix the lack of staffing, alert fatigue, you know, things like that. But what we will fix is hopefully more simplistic ways of looking at complex data that will allow us to be more refined in responding to threats versus the noise. Our challenge has always been the noise. Mm-hmm. We have so much noise out there coming, so many false positives, so many other things that it's so difficult to say, well, that one thing right there out of this 50 million things that I just got is a true positive. So those are the things that I think, you know, when we look at the future, the focus really needs to be on that. You know, there's always going to be innovative ways of protection. There's always going to be innovative ways of other things. But protection takes a really long time to implement in organizations, in our industry, everything else. I mean, it's just not an easy thing. So we're going to have these big security programs that are going to take years and years and years, new initiatives. We're going to do DLP and all this other stuff, whatever it ends up being, CASB or whatever the heck, you know, the newest, latest stuff is. But at the end of the day, you know, our detection programs are really what saves our asses every single day because those are the things that don't require substantial uplifting. As long as we have the visibility, we can make changes very quickly in our environment. And I think that's what we have to look at in the future is saying this process here around when we get this data to when we apply detection engineering to what the analyst sees, that has to be agile in itself. We have to adopt those same principles as the rest of the industry. And I think that will be kind of the saving grace for us in our industry and really make things a lot easier for us to be able to respond.
Yeah, could not agree more. So I've got two final questions for you. Number one is, you know, for anybody that's, you know, looking to get into a security role, a SOC role, you know, we talk a little bit about there's a few different ways you know, that the journey can come, right? What do I need? A formal education, you know, a traditional college education? Do I need certifications? What if I just work my butt off and I study and I just learn stuff? You know, what is the journey that people can come into this world?
Yep. You bring up a great question. It's a complex one. I'll try to make it super quick.
It's all right.
There's multiple different ways that anybody in this industry can find their own way here. And you name them, you mean almost all of them pretty much, you know, straightforward. You can go the college route. The thing I'll caution you on there is, and this is an unfortunate situation, but many of the colleges that we have, and we have folks that interview for them, they're horrible at teaching the knowledge. They're not security practitioners. The you know, information is out of date. And they're a mile wide and thick. So we basically have to completely retrain them. So be really cautious on the actual colleges that you go to. The ones that are NSA accredited are probably my favorite. We see just brilliant kids going through the, you know, NSA red team type of ones. You know, again, having an offense, easy to parlay back into defense, right? Sure. Even any type of initial IT role, like IT help desk, systems administrator roles, those make fantastic security professionals because you understand the architecture, the communications, the protocols. That's the foundation of cybersecurity. So if you can understand those, that's where I came through basically, right? If you can understand all of that, it's easy to build up in your career and to really go into any industry vertical. I think probably becoming a systems administrator or network engineer or a help desk individual, that's probably the best route that I've seen for people to convert over into literally incident response, mm-hmm. being a SOC analyst, you know, offensive capabilities, being a penetration tester, application security, you name it. Same thing for being a developer. If you're a developer, going into web application security, mobile security becomes extremely easy to parlay into that. I think the issue that we run into is that most cases, cybersecurity isn't an entry-level position, right? It's very difficult to say, hey, I have no experience. I need to come now here and do this. And that gap, that bridge in between is what we really struggle with in this industry. You have thousands of kids getting cybersecurity degrees that can't find jobs because everybody wants somebody that's experienced today. So, you know, doing capture the flags, differentiating yourself through certifications can be a decent way. I'm not an end all be all on certs in any way. I think, you know, there's some good ones out there. You know, the Hack of the Box one, the offensive security is great. SANS has some great ones out there. I'll tell you, SANS college program is fantastic.
Yes.
So SANS has a great college program. If you can go that route, you basically do all your entry level stuff, your social studies and, you know, language arts and stuff like that all. And then you go to SANS to get your final degree. They have a bachelor's, associate's, bachelor's, and master's program, I believe. And that's a phenomenal program there. Dakota State University has probably one of the best cybersecurity programs I've ever seen out there. So DSU, definitely love repping them. We've hired so many folks from them, and they've all been rock stars. So, you know, there are good programs out there. But to me, it's understanding the foundation. You can definitely self-teach yourself. If I see somebody with a resume that doesn't have any experience, but they've done CTFs, blog posts, coding examples, things like that, I'm like, okay, that person I can train. Right, they figured it out. It's their obsession, it's their passion, it's a hobby. I can mold them from there. I don't care about them having this experience or this college degree or anything else. It's that passion I think that we look for.
Yeah. I talk about much the same thing, right? And I look for folks that are insatiably curious. You know, they have a driven need to understand. I think the other thing is I love hands-on people. I think those are the folks when you see those two things combine. You know, they've got a lab at home. They've got some sort of virtual thing. It doesn't have to be, you know, 11 boxes and some elaborate network that they've built that's high dollar and all that stuff. It can all be virtual, but show me how you're testing your theories out. You know, when I see that curiosity combined with the hands-on activity, that's usually when I've found somebody that is going to be successful in our world. So
we awesome. Definitely recommend, you know, like on a resume, if you have a college certification, cool. Mm-hmm. But if you have a college certification and you have a GitHub page and blog posts you've done, it doesn't have to be anything like revolutionary. I'm not saying like, hey, you just released this crazy, you know, 0 day that does all this stuff. But, you know, your experiences of how you learn something will help somebody else learn. If you're posting about that, you're showing how you got through certain critical thinking steps. Those are the things that are going to differentiate yourself than anybody else. If you have two candidates that both have the same college degree, you know, but one person has GitHub pages and a blog post and, you know, is studying for the offensive security, you know, certified professional, you know, I'm going to look at that person much more myopically than I am the other. Right. And
absolutely.
So those things make a big difference for sure. And that passion, I can't elaborate enough. Like what made me successful in cybersecurity is cybersecurity wasn't a job. It was my hobby. I loved doing it. I loved exploring things that hadn't been done before, or trying to figure out a topic. I spent 2 weeks in the basement of my house with soda and pizza trying to figure out how to bypass data execution prevention, one of the most frustrating things I've ever done in my life, you know, but I came out of it doing it, you know, and it's that type of pushing yourself forward to learn, to figure out a problem that's complex that, you know, we can't teach you that, right? If we could find folks that have that, they're a shoo-in.
Yeah. And I would encourage for our listeners who may be thinking, I don't have anything, you know, to share with the community. You know what? It doesn't matter. Start with what you're studying. It doesn't have to be groundbreaking. It doesn't have to be innovative. But remember that someone is also starting at the start line. And you may be able to help them get from zero to one. And so that's even something that is obvious, that is well known, well documented, sharing your own journey, your own story, and how you accomplish that, right? That's going to help someone else. So it doesn't have to be, you know, doing what you were doing, right? In terms of, you know, evasion of systems and those kinds of things.
The first tool that I ever wrote was literally a wrapper for DB Autopone and Metasploit. Like, you know, it was a Python script that literally automated DB Autopone. You'd give an IP address, it would select the ports, and then it would select the exploits to go and do the most basic, trivial thing. But yet, you know, it was my first foray into coding, you know, Python, and, you know, kind of learn my tool. You build your career over time, you know, and I think that's what people need to realize is that, you know, you don't need to be an expert day one. I still don't consider myself an expert. I'm always learning, right?
Right.
And it's those things that, those small things that you do over time that build your foundation of that knowledge that continuously elevates you, move you up and up and up to where you get to a point to where you can release something very cool, right?
Absolutely.
And I'm working on a new tool right now, and I'll be releasing it, I think, at GERCON, but it's the Social Engineer Toolkit AI Edition. Mm-hmm. And so I'm building, you know, large language models that help automatically clone websites, rewrite them to do social engineering more effectively and efficiently, analyze the websites for query string parameters that analyze it and tell you what the usernames and passwords are. So, you know, it's like, you know, but I've never done that before. And it just starts off with something really small and turns into something really large, you know, down the road. So it's just, you know, take your time, have fun, but don't spread yourself all over the place. Focus in on some really cool things that you like to do. And that's what you can build your career off of.
Yeah. And I love that we touch on some of these things because imposter syndrome is real and we all struggle with it, right? And I want the folks that are new and coming up in the industry to know that, you know, I don't feel like I have it all together. I don't think you probably feel like you have it all together either, right?
Never. No.
Yeah.
No, it's always learning. And you know, I see so much innovation happening all the time. You know, in our industry. And, you know, even when I was just first starting off, I'm like, man, you know, all these folks have already done it. You know, they've already done all the cool stuff. Like, there's nothing out there for me to even try, right? And that's not true. There's always new ways of innovating, doing cool things, being creative, or just, again, sharing your knowledge. Like, we had a track at a conference that I ran called DerbyCon, and it was new to InfoSec ones. And I'll tell you, to be honest with you, I spent most of my time in those tracks because I was learning from people that were just coming in the industry how they learned, and they learned very differently than I do because, you know, of the new technology progression, they've been, you know, immersed with technology since they were kids and we didn't. So they learned very differently than we do. So it was very creative in a lot of ways that I would hear these folks. It actually helped me be better in my job. So, you know, don't discredit yourself in your career, where you're at. You know that everybody starts from some location to go to different. No one's better than one another. We just have different experiences and journeys that we've taken. And at the end of the day, you can and will be successful if you apply yourself to go and do it. I mean, I am not a smart person when it comes to like you look at people like H.D. Moore, for example.
Sure.
That's a walking brain, right? Like there's no way I'm gonna ever be H.D. Moore, right? You know, it's just not gonna happen. But I've been able to work with my limitations of who I am and still be successful in my industry because I've made it a hobby and been awesome to it.
That's what I love about the pillars of our industry is that they're very encouraging and helping others move forward and move up in the world, right? You and John Strand and Ed Skotis, and you know, there's just so many folks out there that have done so much to give back to the industry, and I love it. I love it. So thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And John, same thing. I mean, we're literally brothers from another mother. You know, couldn't have been any more aligned on who we are as people and in the industry. You know, Black Hills has some incredibly amazing folks over there. You know, love their team, love the people, love the mission that they're doing as well. And, you know, you try to surround yourself with a lot of folks like that, yourself, you know, including that Mick and, you know, a lot of amazing folks out there. Mick Douglas too.
Yeah.
I love Mick. He's such a good dude. I've known Mick for probably 15 years, if not more. You're just good people trying to do good things. And, you know, my mission's always been to make the world a safer place. And, you know, we always continue to give back to the community. We just started a K-12 mission for kids coming into cybersecurity inner city schools that now come to internships here at Trusted Sec, fully paid. Mm-hmm. You know, so just really cool things we're trying to help people. And, you know, again, everybody here can do the same. I started Trusted Sec in the basement of my house with 4 months of rent in the bank. You know, like, had no idea what I was doing, had no idea how to start an LLC, had no idea how to run a business, didn't know what a P&L was. You figure it out as you go along. This doesn't happen overnight.
I love it. I love it. Dave, you're the best, man. So one last question is this. If someone can only take one thing away from this amazing conversation that we've had, what would you have that be?
Detections. Like, to me, making your own environment your own based on the behavior that your company exhibits will save your butt. There's nothing else out there that we have today. No preventative mechanism that can't be circumvented. Where an attacker, where we really flip the script is when an adversary doesn't know the landmine field he's on and he or she is on. And so, you know, when I'm walking forward, if I know CrowdStrike or SentinelOne's there, I know I need to move to the right? Mm-hmm. I need to move forward. But if I've made CrowdStrike or SentinelOne my own and it's my own environment, well, now I move to the right and there's a landmine there, right? And that's what really shifts the entire discussion around being successful in defense and not being successful in defense. And I think if one thing you could take away is if there's one or two positions that I would say they're most critical for this industry right now, it's threat hunting and it's detection engineering. Those are the two top things that we need in our industry right now, understanding adversaries, building that visibility into our environment and making things our own. That's what's going to save us in this industry.
Yeah. In the immortal words of Dr. Eric Cole, prevention is ideal, but detection is a must. He said that in my 401 class years and years ago, and I think still says it today.
Eric's amazing. Love Eric, and holds true to this day, and it holds true from, I think, when he first said it 20 years ago. So
exactly.
You know, it's the same thing. We just need to work on and buckle down on it, and we'll be successful. So
that's right. Well, Dave, I want to say thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time to be with us. Folks, I'm Mick Leach, reminding you, all of our cyber defenders out there, to keep fighting the good fight. You are the tip of the spear, so stay sharp. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget to like and subscribe and check out our other SOC Unlocked episodes. We'll see you all next time. Thank you all.